Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be an empowering hour. My guest in the second part of our program will be Jonathan Greenberg, and the topic will be the need for a more aggressive strategy to defeat Monsanto and Big Agra over GMO labeling. He is an investigative journalist, a Huffington Post blogger, a media innovator dedicated to expanding media democracy. He is the founder of the public interest digital communications company Progressive Source Communications, and he is the creator of NoGMOs.org project. He's been instrumental in helping the movement to label GMOs. He'll be my guest. We'll tell you, how do they win? They play dirty. How can we win? We can play clean and still win. As you see, we're taking on the issues you will not hear on the other media. Let's begin. Let's say you've been taking your vitamins and you're feeling good. And you think, gee whiz, you know, I'm feeling better than I had in the past. And then you start hearing, oh, but they don't do any good. Well, you respect the person on television. After all, they have enormous resources that you don't. So let's say that next time around, you just don't take your vitamins. Why should I? It's just a waste of money. And then we come in and try to make sense of the confusion. For over 20 years, there has been an ongoing attack. Almost always behind the scene is the hidden hand of Big Pharma and their front groups to give them a firewall of plausible deniability. Or in front of the special groups, the foundations, the think tanks, are consumer groups that when you look, they're really not consumer groups at all. They're funded by Big Pharma. Two flawed studies and an editorial published in the current issue of the Annals of Internal Medicine have attempted to discredit the value of multivitamin supplements. But the studies were plagued by grievous methodological flaws. Were they intentional or just bad science at its worst, what I call guttural science? In one of the studies, subjects were given low-quality, low-potency multiple vitamin supplements. Treatment adherence rates and dropout rates were horrendous in these studies. Nevertheless, mainstream sources are using these reprehensible studies to undermine dietary supplements. The first study examined the cognitive effects of low-potency multiple vitamin supplements in aging male participants. Not surprisingly, the conclusions in the present analysis question the value of multiple vitamins benefiting cognition. In the other studies, subjects with a history of heart attack were given a multiple vitamin supplement or placebo and monitored for about 4.5 years for cardiovascular events. Despite succumbing to heinous design flaws, this study actually revealed evidence that multiple vitamins reduce cardiovascular risk. However, investigators constructed the study so as to ignore anything short of miraculous cardiovascular risk reduction. So the conclusion drawn questions multiple vitamin benefits. Now, these major gaffes in study design and methodology are not being discussed anywhere in the media. And why would you expect anyone in alternative media to discuss it, since they don't believe in vitamins to begin with? Oh, but they do believe in vaccines. That's what is almost incomprehensible, that people who are supposed to be more progressive really aren't when it comes to looking for the truth. So let's deconstruct this argument, and we will post this on our website today. First, let's take a look at the poor adherence criteria. Subjects in the first study were considered to have adhered to their multiple vitamin regimen appropriately if they took it just two-thirds of the time. Let me repeat that. Two-thirds. I've never heard of a study in my life. I've conducted 47 clinical studies with 40,000 people. They have been published. I presented before International Symposium of Scientists, thousands of scientists. There are standards you must adhere to. If I got up in front of a group of scientists as I did in Washington, D.C., with 4,000 scientists, and talked about how I was able to help reverse menopausal symptoms in a group of 287 women. And if I said, well, sometimes they ate well, a lot of times they didn't. Sometimes they took it, sometimes they supplemented, sometimes they exercised. They would just be shaking their head saying, we haven't proven anything yet. And they would be correct. To adhere to something means you adhere to it. You have to do it every single day, and you have to prove that you're doing it every single day. And if not, then you have to be excluded from the study because you will bias and change the outcome of the study. In other words, even subjects who skipped their multiple vitamins 4 months out of the year were deemed adherent to the intervention. Immediately, that would disqualify any legitimate study from being published. So now we have to ask about motives. Then there was a weak questionnaire data that relies on recollection. In addition, the method by which adherence was assessed in this study is inherently weak. Study subjects were simply asked to report how adherent they were in their assigned intervention once a year. This study is based on recollection and is particularly prone to bias. More rigorous studies properly measure compliance by asking participants to return unused study product so adherence can be directly qualified. Also, in all of my studies, people must maintain a daily diary. And at the end of each week, when they come back, if they do not have their diary, if it's not filled out, they're excluded from the study. They no longer participate. You have to have strict adherence. And you can't have someone have all the same writing, you know, then they didn't do it. They just took one day and wrote everything down. No, it has to be daily, not once a year. Could you remember what you did and how you felt, and what you took and what you didn't take, and what you ate and what you didn't eat a year after? No, no one can. Low-potency vitamins was also part of this. A multiple vitamin utilized in this study contained woefully inadequate nutrient concentrations. For example, the formula contained only 60 milligrams of vitamin C, 25 micrograms of vitamin B12, 20 micrograms of selenium. Now, any health-conscious person in America knows that these abysmally small nutrient doses are very unlikely to deliver any considerable health benefits. Even the researchers state a limitation of their study, quote, the doses of the vitamins may be too low. You think? Yeah, we know. I start individuals at 1,000 micrograms per day on B12 and a methylated B12. I start people with cognitive dysfunction at 3 to 5,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C, not 60 milligrams. 60 milligrams of vitamin C is not therapeutic. Despite the very low potency of vitamins used in this trial, benefits were seen in the multiple vitamin group. For example, after 2.5 years of treatment with a low-potency multiple vitamin, there was an improvement seen in cognitive function compared to controls, although this did not reach statistical significance. Multiple vitamins contained several nutrients shown to affect cognitive decline. Vitamin B6, B12, folic acid are important for methylation reactions that are crucial to the health of brain tissue. Deficiency of these nutrients is associated with severe impairment of brain function. One placebo-controlled trial revealed that men and women with mild cognitive impairment who were supplemented with vitamin B6, B12, folic acid for 24 months experienced a 29% less brain atrophy and higher cognitive test scores compared to those that received a placebo. Numerous studies have implicated oxidative stress in the pathology of mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease. Antioxidants, vitamin C, E, and beta-carotene protect the brain from oxidative damage. Evidence strongly suggests that vitamin A exerts actions on brain physiology and behavior in adult life. For example, an active metabolite of vitamin A, retinoic acid, is a potent signaling molecule in the brain and helps regulate nerve cell growth, nerve survival, and synaptic pliability. In a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial involving more than 200 healthy middle-aged individuals, subjects were given either a multiple vitamin or placebo for more than 2 months, and both groups were then assessed for cognitive function. It was shown that those taking the multiple vitamin displayed less fatigue during the extended cognitive challenges and were more accurate. Also, those taking multiple vitamins were able to more quickly complete mathematical processing tests than subjects receiving placebo. An 8-week double-blind placebo-controlled trial of multiple vitamins in men aged 50 to 74 was published in 2012. They found that multiple vitamin supplements significantly improve some aspects of memory and cognition. Quote, relative short-term supplementation with a multiple vitamin can benefit risk factors for cognitive decline, end quote. So on the one hand, there are many studies published in peer-reviewed journals that had proper protocol designs and adherence with outstanding results. Why didn't the media choose to take some time and look for the truth? But they didn't. Then concerning the cardiovascular event study, first there was poor adherence standards. In the cardiovascular event study, a staggering 46, let me repeat that so we're all clear on this, 46% of the people discontinued the multiple vitamin regimen during the study. That meant that this study was completely, totally worthless and should immediately have been stopped. But it wasn't. And none of this was reported to the mainstream media. It is incomprehensible that the investigators felt it was acceptable to generate an analysis of efficacy when nearly half of the active treatment group failed to adhere to the treatment. In addition, it is reprehensible that the editors at the Annals of Internal Medicine allowed this methodologically, grossly, completely flawed research to be published in their journal. Shame on the Annals of Internal Medicine, your entire editorial staff, and everyone associated with this complete and total perversion of science. This audience knows the truth because they have seen it. Attaining ideal health is a lifetime endeavor that requires regular use of high-quality and comprehensive nutrient supplements. Two figures included in the report demonstrated reduced cardiovascular event rates for the multiple vitamin group, although these did not reach statistical significance. These benefit generally increased over the duration of 4.5. For example, despite concluding that multiple vitamins don't protect against cardiovascular risk, the investigators did find an 11% reduction in their primary endpoint, composite of time to death from any cause of heart attack, stroke, coronary or hospitalization events. Also, there was an 18% reduction in the secondary endpoint, meaning cardiovascular death, heart attack, or stroke. We have found more than 1,000 studies in the last 24 hours in peer-reviewed journals showing that nutrients such as coenzyme Q10, L-carnosine, N-acetylcysteine, vitamin E, mixed tocopherols, vitamin C, and hawthorn, and many other nutrients can reduce the incidence of cardiovascular events. Why weren't these referenced? Why weren't these used as a template? Why didn't the media say, well, we have 1,000 studies where people adhered to the protocols, where you gave them large amounts of nutrients, and they had these wonderful benefits and turned around and lessened their rates of disease? But they didn't. Shame on the New York Times and all the other media for not doing your homework. You do a disservice to everyone. And also then we must challenge the absurd efficacy assumptions. A major part of the study design involves defining effects thresholds that can be statistically elucidated based upon the number of subjects and trial duration. In this study, the authors designed the trial to detect a 25% reduction in cardiovascular risk. In other words, for this trial to conclude that multiple vitamins provided cardiovascular benefit, the intervention would have had to have eliminated 1 in 4 cardiovascular events outcomes. By setting that bar of efficacy so high, the study was set up to conclude that multiple vitamins would prove of no benefit. Or let me put it this simple. If you were to determine that every single drug in existence for cancer had to have a 25% efficacy rate, there would be no treatment for cancer using drugs. The same would be true for arthritis. The same would be true for even antibiotics. This is insane and absurd. Also, why is it you selected more diabetic patients for a group receiving multiple vitamins? Diabetes is one of the strongest known risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Therefore, it is critically important that any study examining cardiovascular outcomes make sure that all groups of participants have similar baseline rates of diabetes. If not, the group with greater diabetes frequency will almost certainly have disproportionately higher cardiovascular risk. In this flawed Annals of Internal Medicine study, subjects in the multiple vitamin group had higher rates of diabetes at baseline than those who received the placebo. This difference in diabetes rate may have biased the results. And although the researchers who conducted this study referred to the multiple vitamin preparation as high potency, that is not true. One of the most critically important components of cardiovascular health was virtually absent completely from the formula. The multiple vitamin utilization in this study contained a mere 100 units of vitamin D. To people in this audience, they're going to think that's insane. How is that possible? That's completely stupid. You don't put 100 units of vitamin D3 and call it efficacious. No, 1,000, yes. 5,000, now you're in the market. 5,000, no. 100, that's what they used. We advocate 1,000 times on this program, 2,000 to 3,000 international units of vitamin D a day. Another critical heart nutrient, vitamin B12, was so low to be insignificant. It lowers levels of blood vessel damaging amino acid homocysteine, which is associated with cardiovascular risk. The multiple vitamin formula in this flawed study contained just 100 micrograms B12. Minimally, I would advocate 600 units a day, and that's with people not suffering a problem. Then, while the alpha-tocopherol form of vitamin E was included in the multiple vitamin, the gamma-tocopherol was not. This is important because the scientific evidence shows that in the absence of gamma-tocopherol, alpha-tocopherol alone may not provide meaningful cardiovascular protection. Moreover, evidence suggests that supplementation with only alpha-tocopherol may actually reduce levels of protective gamma-tocopherol. The alpha form of vitamin E decreases oxidative damage in the arterial lining, reduces dangerous aggregation and clumping of red blood cells, and delays clot formation. It also inhibits smooth muscle proliferation involved in the plaque-forming process, improves stability of fatty plaques, enhances function of cell lining the arteries, regulates vascular tone, and fights inflammation. Despite these impressive findings in thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature, clinical trials of alpha-tocopherol alone have yielded mixed results concerning its protective effects of the heart. This may be due to the role of gamma-tocopherol on cardiovascular health, since high-dose alpha dramatically reduces gamma-tocopherol levels. Alpha-tocopherol benefits may be overshadowed by the adverse effects of diminished gamma-tocopherol levels. And by the way, gamma-tocopherol is important in defending against cardiovascular disease. Several investigations confirm that higher tissue concentrations of gamma-tocopherol are associated with lower rates of illness and death in cardiovascular disease. In fact, several studies show that patients with advanced cardiovascular disease exhibit normal plasma levels of alpha-tocopherol but have substantially low levels of gamma-tocopherol. In a 7-year follow-up study of 334,000 postmenopausal women with no previous heart disease, greater intake of dietary vitamin E, consisting predominantly of gamma-tocopherol, was strongly associated with a lower risk of death from cardiovascular disease. Despite the opinions shared by the authors of the editorial, other research has shown the multiple vitamins protect against cancer and cardiovascular disease. For example, the Physicians' Health Study found that multiple vitamin supplementation was associated with a 12% reduction in overall cancer incidence after 11.2 years of follow-up. In addition, the Supplementation in Vitamins and Mineral Antioxidant Study found a 31% reduction in total cancer incidence in men that supplemented with a multiple vitamin. And when the results in men were combined with the physicians' health study, the risk of all cancers was reduced over a 10-year period. The study found 39% reduction in fatal heart attacks in those taking multiple vitamins. In addition, several trials have shown considerable benefit associated with supplementation, and we have posted those. One study this year enrolled 88,000 postmenopausal women, reported that vitamin B6 and riboflavin intake from diet and supplements reduced the risk of colorectal and postmenopausal women, the cancer did. And another study, 2007, that enrolled 81,000 women, found that low levels of B6 is associated with an increased risk of colorectal cancer. Another study this year of 77,000 men and women ages 50 to 76 found an average inverse relationship between how much selenium you take and the risk of pancreatic cancer. The more selenium, the less risk. In another study this year, the European researchers published results of a large study of 23,943 subjects who took antioxidant vitamin supplements over an average of 11 years. Individuals who use antioxidant multiple vitamins were 48% less likely to die from cancer and 42% less likely to die to any cause compared to antioxidant vitamin non-users. In conclusion, based upon an analysis of these studies and the existing research, we and Life Extension and all legitimate health-conscious people continue to recommend high-quality, high-potency multiple vitamin supplements taken in combination. These people seem to be clueless in the dark ages, dinosaurs. They don't even know about curcumin, coenzyme Q10, PQQ, carnosine, lipoic acid, and other nutrients and hormone stimulators that play crucial roles in maintaining optimal health against cardiovascular disease. And we are fully footnoted and fully referenced for everything I have said. And I challenge today on the air, I challenge the publisher of the New York Times, I challenge the editorial director, I challenge the managing editor of the New York Times, please come on this program and explain to us how you could have allowed this kind of absolutely guttural reporting to appear in such a prestigious journal of record. This is reprehensible. Was it intentional? Were you shilling for Big Pharma? Or was this just bad reporting? We deserve an answer. We demand an answer. Until such time, I'm asking my audience to boycott the New York Times, the Washington Post, because we cannot trust you. You've lost our confidence on anything involving health, just like Consumers Report. They know how to test a toaster, but man, are they wrong and biased when it comes to talking about anything involving health. And then we find out how the quackbusters have been counseling them for a long time. I'm Gary Nall. We are the place that will take on the lies, the deceptions, with scholarship, with science, and we will tell you the truth. Where these people, where they're just pathetic, and yet they're the power ones. And that's unfortunate. We now go to a letter from Steve Brown to the New York Times involving an article they published last week called "It's Hard to Summon Sympathy for Big Banks." It does a very good job of summing up sympathy for big banks. According to Steve Brown's, "All shucks," implies the New York Times, the banks, just made a few silly mistakes. Or, as the article put it, quote from the New York Times, "It's not a crime to make a stupid mistake. And much of what happened in the years before the financial crisis was more foolish than venal," end quote. Steve Brown replies, "That is not only special pleading, it is factually incorrect. It is also an astonishingly brazen lie, since it is inconceivable that the writer of this article does not know that our biggest banks were found to have committed, or have confessed to committing, thousands upon thousands of real and deliberate crimes, some of which rank among the largest financial crimes in history, such as the LIBOR falsification, phony mortgage scams, and an $800 billion worth of drug money laundered through HSBC, to give just three examples. Yes, we expect to see corporate-friendly spin from the Times, but outright lying to prop up the myth of corporate innocence seems like something new. Could it be that the New York Times editors aren't fact-checking their business articles anymore, or have they simply been asked not to?" Stephen Brown. We will continue to offer a challenge to the New York Times. I'm Gary Nall. This is an original investigative reporting piece where now we go from taking on one medical false report this week to one that is visibly there for the world to read and be objective, but we have not found it's objective or honest. Here is our response to Bill Gates, Project Tycho, and Vaccine Voodoo by scholar-in-residence Richard Gale and myself, as published today on the Progressive Radio Network and on my Facebook. You'll be able to read it, fully footnoted. Population cohort and ecologic studies have become common today. They're the norm for determining vaccine efficacy and support the belief that vaccination has safely reduced the spread of infectious disease and saved millions of lives. Never a gold standard for scientific inquiry, population studies now make up the bulk of vaccine advocates' clinical arsenal to discredit more factual biological research favoring the arguments of vaccine opponents. A recent paper published just this last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, quote, "Contagious diseases in the United States from 1988 to the present is the first of what will inevitably turn into a flurry of future studies to persuade state legislators, federal legislators, and the public that vaccination should be mandated for assuring the health of the nation. The study has spawned from a new project launched at the University of Pittsburgh called Project Tycho, named after the renowned 16th century astronomer and mathematician and mentor of Kepler. It was funded by Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. The project is an enormous multi-tiered undertaking to store death data for 56 different infectious diseases between 1888 and the present for future data mining and analysis and to strategize future policies to increase vaccine rates. The paper's authors make the extraordinary claim that, quote, 103 million cases of childhood disease have been prevented since 1924. In the past decade alone, 26 million cases were prevented from vaccination. Always the obedient slave to the CDC and Big Pharma demands, the New York Times once again chimed in, stating that this, quote, is one of the kind of analysis that can be done when enormous data sets are built in mind, end quote. If this analysis is factual, it can be heralded as one of the most significant achievements to support the miracles and benefits of vaccines. On the other hand, if the University of Pittsburgh researchers' analysis is scientifically unreliable and perhaps even found deceptive under some empirical review, then the paper is one of the most misleading propaganda scams published in a peer-reviewed medical literature in recent years. This wouldn't be the first time the New England Journal of Medicine failed to perform diligent and satisfactory peer review of papers submitted for publication. In the past, the prestigious journal has been rife with publishing duplicitous scientific articles that are best described as medical racketeering. What is more important is to review the data that the Pittsburgh scientists depended upon in order to reach their conclusions, and we have done that. A review of the Project Tycho website and its database reveals an absence of the most critical information necessary for making any historical determination about a vaccine's effectiveness, let alone how many deaths were prevented. We will now deconstruct the entire story. It may be a little scientific, but I will break it into lay language. But it's important that we know this, because if we do not know this, then you can reasonably expect in the near future that all state legislators will be mandating more and more vaccines for everyone because, quote, it's in the public best interest to create herd immunity to protect everyone. But it's a fraud. The project's sole accomplishment is to store vast amounts of data, 200 million keystrokes of mortality statistics, including time and location for 56 infectious diseases over a 125-year period. scientific data pertaining to vaccination statistics for 8 vaccine-specific contagious diseases noted in the New England Journal of Medicine is non-existent. But let me repeat that, New York Times, because this you failed to catch. The scientific data pertaining to vaccination statistics for 8 vaccine-specific contagious diseases simply does not exist. There is no record for the number of people vaccinated for any of the targeted diseases in any given year or location. There is no record for the number of deaths among unvaccinated persons, nor are there any records of deaths caused by an infectious disease that may have been caused by a vaccine's infectious agent or in a data set of the population where the vaccine was ineffective and did not provide protection. In fact, the project contains no data regarding vaccination data at all. I simply could not believe how poor this was. I would fail any student of mine who turned in a paper trying to put something over on you. Let me restate myself. The project contains no data regarding vaccination data at all. In addition, the data makes the priori assumption that the cause of reported deaths due to the infectious disease that are tracked over the course of 125 years is accurate. Of course, for the majority of this period, accurate biological diagnostic techniques to determine an infectious cause of death simply did not exist or were not routinely performed. So how did the Pittsburgh scientists derive their conclusions? To understand their modus operandi, the reader of the New York Times and the New England Journal of Medicine is asked to lay aside the most basic principles of the scientific method and critical thought. Whether it would be better to cast our minds back 500 years and adopt an irrational bias that finds more in common with alchemy and magical beliefs than modern science. Without the crucial data for making enough rough estimates for the number of vaccinated and non-vaccinated individuals for any given year in order to make an appropriate calculation, the study's method is quite simple. Quote from the study, "We estimated the number of cases of polio, measles, rubella, mumps, hepatitis A, diphtheria, and pertussis that were prevented by vaccines by subtracting the reported number of weekly cases after the introduction of vaccines from a simulated counterfactual number of cases that would have occurred in the absence of vaccination," end quote. A dictionary's definition for counterfactual numbers would be a number that relates to something that has not happened or a case that does not exist. In other words, it is magically conjured as a number relying upon mathematical algorithms with no genuine correspondence to the reality of infectious rates. Moreover, the paper states it relies upon a quantitative history, which translates merely into simply plain numbers of deaths counts without qualifying what those numbers actually represent in any significant quantitative way, e.g. vaccinated versus non-vaccinated, margins of error for misdiagnosis causes of death, the rising number of cases of people contracting infections they had been vaccinated against, the fact that mortality rates for most of the 8 preventable infectious diseases under investigation were already declining rapidly before the introduction of vaccines is also ignored completely and categorically. What the Pittsburgh team overlooks is the rapid declining numbers of deaths before the release of specific vaccines. Now, an excellent example is the death rates due to measles. Before the advent of a measles vaccine in 1963, death rates had already dropped 98.6%. Let me repeat that. Before there was a vaccine, we had already dropped 98.6% of all the people dying of measles. And that goes clear back to the time that records were kept. This steady decline started to plateau to less than 1 per 100,000 in 1944 and gradually diminished during the remaining years. Aside from an abnormal spike in 1990, after the measles vaccine became part of the standard vaccination schedule. In 1959, the rate was approximately 1.5 million, approaching zero before the vaccine's 1963 release. And since this study ignores any potential reason for the 90.6% drop in measles death before 1963, there's no rationale to conclude that measles vaccine prevented any deaths whatsoever. Given the many decades of declining prior to the vaccine in death, whatever the cause or causes for this downward movement, it is very likely to have continued to where measles death rates are today without a vaccine ever being developed. Meaning if we didn't even have a vaccine today, we wouldn't have measles either. For example, there was never a vaccine, never, for scarlet fever. However, in the United Kingdom, it declined from being one of the most deadly infectious diseases with a death rate of 160 in 100,000 around 1860 to zero by 1940. But no vaccine. Likewise, pertussis was already rapidly declined before the vaccine became widely available in the 1940s. In what has now become a standardized assault against parents who either delay or withhold vaccinating their children, the Pittsburgh Arthurs want us to believe that non-vaccinated children were responsible for the recent increase in pertussis cases. However, putting aside the pertussis vaccine's litany of serious and life-threatening risks, data regarding its efficacy is gradually revealing this vaccine as one of medicine's major debacles. What the authors fail to question is whether the vaccine itself might be responsible for this escalation. Dr. Roeding Lan and his colleagues, University of New South Wales, have identified a new vaccine resistance genotype, a pertussis called the PTXP3, that has increased dramatically. It was responsible for 30% of whooping cough cases before 2008 epidemic to 84% of whooping cough cases in Australia today. This new and more deadly strain, according to the CDC, is now being reported in the United States, and there's a growing body of research pointing to recent whooping cough outbreaks being directly linked to the vaccine. You want to get this deadly whooping cough? Take the vaccine. This alone may account for the increase of whooping cough cases being referred to in the New England Journal of Medicine paper and a reason why vaccinated children are coming down with the infection as well. After all, if the vaccine worked, why are all these kids who are vaccinated coming down with the very conditions they were vaccinated for and worse than if it had happened without being vaccinated? The foremost question scientists should be concerning themselves with, rather than investing millions of dollars to play computer games with magical numbers, is to determine whether the DPT vaccine is responsible for the emergence of vaccine-resistant pertussis outbreaks. Yet, there's even more damning research against the pertussis vaccine and its failures. In 2009, the CDC determined that 99.9%, let me repeat that, 99.94% of American children were vaccinated against pertussis. Therefore, the herd immunity threshold was surpassed. And according to this unproven theory, there should be no transmission, zero. A recent FDA biological study performed on young baboons discovered that the pertussis vaccine, while possibly protecting against wild infection, in fact doesn't eliminate infection. Rather, the study found the vaccinated baboons are colonizing the virus. That's terrible. And transmitting it to each other. If this research holds up, it debunks completely any credibility that may be given to the belief in herd immunity. The article also makes reference to the large 2010 pertussis outbreak, but fails to mention that according to a study published in the December 2012 issue of the Journal of Pediatrics, among the 9,000-plus cases in California, the largest among the states, 91% of those who came down have been, quote, fully vaccinated according to national recommendations. That means your vaccine didn't work. You're putting children at risk of death. How responsible is that? During the 1986 pertussis outbreak in Kansas, 90% of the confirmed cases had been fully vaccinated. This high percentage of outbreaks among vaccinated children is common during recent pertussis spikes in different locations. So, who is truly endangering society? The pertussis vaccine is one instance where widespread vaccination is backfiring and increasing the incidence of infection, hospitalization, and death. However, none of this hard historical and qualitative statistics are factored into the Project Tycho's calculations. None. The University of Pittsburgh's New England Journal of Medicine article is a grand alchemical illusion of misinformation. The researchers either lack or ignore the most critical data and statistics necessary to arrive at medically valid conclusions about the causes of behind deaths attributed to viral and bacterial infectious disease. Therefore, the report is best viewed as an archaic, pseudo-scientific attempt to discredit vaccine opponents and advance Bill Gates and his cohort's ambitions to legally mandate vaccination and decimate health freedom for individuals and parents to make their own decisions regarding medical interventions for themselves and their children. Wherever Bill Gates' funding footprint is found in vaccine-related endeavors, we can be certain it is to advance his departing legacy as the foremost leader to vaccinate every infant and child on the planet, irrespective of vaccine's dangers and whether or not they are as effective as the CDC and the vaccine makers want. On an upcoming program, I will devote exclusively to what Bill Gates stated at a conference about how to population control through vaccines. That concerns all of us. Finally, there's a telling aftermath in the New England Journal of Medicine article and the New York Times introducing Project Tycho, T-Y-C-H-O, to the public. Why would a project aimed at increasing vaccination rates name their initiative after an astronomer credited with laying out the foundation for the Keplerian laws of planetary motion? There is a perfectly good motive to name the project after the famous 16th century Danish astronomer, but it's not one that Gates nor the university want to acknowledge. Tycho's significance for a vaccine initiative has nothing to do with the formidable scientists' observations of the movements of celestial bodies. Rather, it is Tycho, the notorious alchemist, we need to turn to in order to understand the project's patron saint. And here we find Tycho's alchemy mirroring Bill Gates' financial support for scientists to summon the ghost of fallacious magical statistics conjured through algorithms to mislead the media and public. One of the greatest fears parents express against vaccinating their children concern vaccines' magic toxic chemicals and ingredients in vaccines' serious and life-threatening adverse effects. For many decades, the scientific literature has documented a wide variety of neurological and physical disorders attributed to vaccines. Many of these long-term reactions, developmental and neurological impairment, asthma and allergies, type 1 diabetes, GI tract, etc., are and being observed in epidemic proportions in children. As I have noted, the University of Pittsburgh researchers completely disregarded the questions concerning vaccines' efficacy and safety in their study. We have not. 27 standalone articles by Richard Gale and myself, fully documented, able to withstand cross-examination in a court of law, show the lack of safety or efficacy in any vaccine, let alone combinations. They're worth reading. It could save someone's life. They're posted on our website. Their methodology resides strictly in the abstract world of mathematical make-believe. Removal from the hard sciences of immunology, molecular biology, and toxicology. I'm Gary Knoll with Richard Gale. Let us go now to my guest who is standing by for the final part of our program. I gave you his background earlier, Jonathan Greenberg. Nice to have you with us today, Jonathan.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Gary.
Jonathan Greenberg is an investigative journalist, Huffington Post blogger, a media innovator, as I mentioned earlier, and he is the founder of the public interest digital communication company Progressive Sources, Source Communications, and the creator of the NoGMO.org project, and he has been helping everywhere to get GMO products labeled. Jonathan, in both California and more recently in Washington State, the large majority of voters wanted GMO labeling turned into law. In Washington, the bill had about 90% public support. With that kind of public support, there's no reason why the bill should have been defeated by Monsanto's dirty tricks, which you have noted were similar to the GOP swift vote method, unless there is something terribly wrong with how the bill's organizers are conveying their message. Everyone wants to blame Monsanto and the millions of dollars they spent to defeat the GMO labeling bill rather than the fault of the organizers on the ground. So please begin by telling us the basic strategy Monsanto used, because they're going to continue to do the same in bills pending in other states and future GMO labeling bills. And why has their message more effective in its receptance than the message of the campaigners for GMO labeling in California and Washington?
It's a great question, Gary. I think I'll go back to the beginning of the GMO campaign in California, in which, as they received some money and a lot of names on petitions, they did a poll, and their poll found that citizens don't like negative campaigning. They have to stick to the positive. And that positive was the right to know, as opposed to something like the right to safe food, for example, which would touch on health concerns. Monsanto had no such problems, Monsanto and biotech, in going right for the jugular, in being entirely negative in its campaign. And, of course, what you know and I know, being investigative reporters, you follow the money, and the guys who are being paid five or six times as much money per hour and having larger budgets typically have more experience and professionalism, and their professionalism says, go for the lies, go for the negative. And so what the campaigns came out with, this is a bill by lawyers, this is a bill that will cause confusion and cause consumers $300 each household for relabeling, none of which was at all true, but it was all negative. By seeding the message, I think it comes down to the message of the campaigners, both in California and startlingly, after seeing the failure in California, the Washington organizers got right behind them and did the same exact mistake, was, we are telling you have a right to know, but we're not going to say anything about why you should want to know. And that big why has to do with food safety and the dangers of GMO food that is drawing people like me, who's a parent of two young children, and, you know, thousands, millions of people around the country, to be concerned about GMO. It is, we're ingesting a pesticide into our blood that stays there, that kills insects when it's eating the seed and eating the plant that we're eating. Well, what is that doing to our bodies? So what we found is that not only did they say that we're not going to lead with this, they refused and forbade any people receiving money from the campaign or any space on the website of the campaign to say the word, you know, health safety. And so they ceded that ground to Monsanto and biotech, who had five times more money for their disinformation campaigns, to say, this is, no study has ever concluded that this is unsafe. It's been found to be perfectly safe. And astonishingly, Monsanto and Co. trotted out people in white lab coats to say, I'm very concerned about the confusion of my patients. And it was like, this nightmare, this train wreck, watching this train wreck that happened in California happen again in Washington.
All right. After Monsanto and its cohorts launched television ads to frighten voters with misinformation, Jeffrey Smith and Lori Grace provided Richard Gale and I with links to the TV ads that the campaign organizers and committee were considering as a rebuttal. We were in close contact with Jeffrey during the California campaign and even warned him. I personally warned him that Monsanto had likely infiltrated the campaign, which they could have done and because they had the means to. When we saw the proposed TV ads, they were utterly lame. And our first response was, how could these people be so limited to ignore the most important point for labeling GMOs, their high health risks and irreversible damage to the environment and the future of agriculture? You have a lot to share about why the most important message to defeat GMO was ignored by Proposition 37 campaigners. So tell us, what have you found from your investigation?
What I found, you know, during the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy SF and Sebastopol, you know, efforts which I was part of, there was an expression that many of us felt, which is that the existing institutions, Gary, are failing us. And we looked at our political institutions and our government, where it's pretty obvious when the FDA appoints, you know, a Monsanto top executive to be its food safety czar, how that's failing. What's less obvious to many of us is how our nonprofit organizations are failing us. How the good guy organizations and how the so-called professional organizations. And everyone, you know, I think it's more a case of everyone wants to cover their ass, in a sense, and look good for their job and their funders and the money they're raising. And they, and so it's like, well, this is professional. I've talked to the grassroots organizers in California, and at some point, the larger money organizations came in and said, we're hiring the professional. You ladies, get out of the way. You grassroots people, get out of the way. And what the professionals felt was just, and I know Gary and Lori, too, by the way. Lori helped us with some ads that we came out with online that talked about health concerns. On, you know, which, you know, and we also, you know, I funded these GMO people making their own videos for People Powered Media, which talked about health concerns. We were supplying them free to the campaign. They refused to air a single one because, in their words, they might talk about public health or mention Jeffrey Smith. They would not, Gary, even mention his name. But a fellow like Jeffrey, who went to college with me, interestingly enough, and is great, you know, he is stuck in the middle because the professional organizations are
Hold on one second. Hold on one second. I'm not going to let anyone get away with this. I'm sick of all these people who are now the heads of these groups, including Bill McKibben, who I consider extremely naive. Mm-hmm. I want to see these people either be a part of a true grassroots movement and share with them or get out of the way because this is BS to me, and we're going to go forward without any of these so-called experts in any of these NGOs because I trust none of them.
I agree completely. I mean, they have to either change their tactics or get out of the way. And that's what both my article in the Huffington Post, New Tougher Tactics Desperately Needed, you know, and it was a very controversial article. I agree completely. What I'm saying is I think what it is it's this sense of, well, we're a team and this is what we decided. And it is so hierarchical and out of touch with the grassroots and what people want, and so self-defeating that their institutions are failing as they try to be professional. I mean, you know, you have a group like, anyway, there are all over the place. You have many nonprofit and progressive organizations that are failing to listen and failing to create a way for the grassroots people to express their voices. I mean, they were making us sell lawn signs for $10 each. It's not enough to, you know, to fund it. They had zero money for lawn signs. So people would have to, instead of knock on door and say, can I put a sign in your prominent lawn for $2, you know, which a campaign pays for, it says, would you like to buy a sign for $10 to put in your lawn? It was ludicrous.
That's just
I mean,
stupid.
They should have been, they put zero money for anything but TV ads.
Well, let's do this, Jonathan. We're going to work together with real grassroots, with the people who know what it is to be victims of the of Monsanto and others and are not going to stand by and watch the NGOs and others, even with the best of intents, misguide and hence destroy our opportunity to ban GMOs. We're going to be on top of this. Give us your website, please.
It's, No GMO is KNOWGMO.org, and ProgressiveSource.com does think people-powered media to counter deceptive corporate TV ads. And, you know, and I agree completely, and I think the grassroots, Gary, also needs to speak the members of these organizations, to go to the heads of the organizations and say, listen, you know all about this. This is why we got into this organization, because we're concerned about our safety and our health and our ecology, and so are you. Talk about it. Otherwise, I'm quitting. I'm not going to send you my $20 check each year.
I think we should stop sending any of these groups money and just start reorganizing the grass up. When Al Gore started throwing footballs on Friday afternoon lunches with the head of the environmental movements, on that day I saw that photo. I said, the movement has been co-opted. Thank you very much, Jonathan Greenberg, for all your good work out there in Sebastopol, California. And we look forward to working together with regular people. We're going to bypass all the other so-called experts, and we're going to get some stuff done.
Thank you very much, Gary.
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.